Today on Inside Utah Politics, union organizers double the signature threshold. What now stands in the way of putting Utah's controversial collective bargaining ban on the ballot? And election security concerns flaring up on Capitol Hill. Why the House Speaker is calling for a change in how a local county clerk is responding. Plus, Governor Cox talking hot topics from immigration to rebuilding the Salt Palace. We've got highlights from his monthly press conference.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrts.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I am Lindsay Ehrts. Let's go inside Utah politics. Well, Utah's public labor leaders say they've submitted over 320,000 signatures needed to put a referendum on the ballot to repeal a controversial ban on collective bargaining. That would more than double the threshold of just over 140,000 signatures they need to let voters weigh in on the ban that would ban public sector collective bargaining. But county clerks and the lieutenant governor's office still need to verify those signatures. And there's a campaign working to get Utahns to rescind their signatures.
There are people out there already trying to scare supporters, trying to confuse them, trying to convince them to remove their names. Don't fall for it. If you signed the petition, keep your name. If you believe in nurses, teachers, first responders, and public workers, stand with us.
Well, while the raw number of signatures may be impressive, the unions still need to make sure they have the signatures from 8% of voters in 15 of 29 Senate districts. That means the rescission campaign could flip as few as a few hundred voters. Well, I'm joined today by Kevin Green. He's the state director of the Utah chapter for Americans for Prosperity. Excuse me, they're a conservative group here in Utah. Kevin, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so you heard it there. The group's a little bit concerned that your group's coming out to get people to rescind signatures. Talk to me about your rescission efforts. What will those look like?
Yeah, so I mean, initially we started our decline to sign campaign trying to prevent people from signing by telling them, you know, our thoughts on the bill, why HB 267 is good. The rescission campaign will be on our behalf essentially the same thing, talking to people about what the bill really does, why this protects taxpayer dollars, why it ensures accountability, and really just, you know, get them over to our side and encouraging them to remove their name from the petition.
Yeah, so how does your national chapter kind of get involved in that? And then are there any local, like, major donors that come in and contribute?
So nationally, right, we are a 36-chapter organization. We have a presence in all 50 states. We work on our local issues as a state chapter, so Kentucky and Texas and everyone else is working on their issues in AFP Utah. We've got a small but mighty team of five, and we, you know, pick the issues that we see as important to help keep Utah leading.
So part of the effort is to rescind signatures, but oftentimes you get a signature gathering company, right, to help you do that. Utah's thresholds are just significant enough, right, that y'all need help, right? So have you guys hired somebody? Will they go door to door? Like, what does that kind of look like?
Yeah, so we have not done that right now. What we're looking at is mobilizing our grassroots army. We're made up of thousands of volunteers and activists across the state, really connecting them with, you know, the people in their area who have signed, and initially starting like, hey, if you know them, let's talk to them. Let's tell them why HB 267 is good policy, and then we can ask them to remove from there.
Talk to me about that policy. Why do you believe it's good policy to ban collective bargaining?
Yeah, so we collectively and holistically, we thought every aspect of the bill was great. A major component, and I think what is getting most of the attention, is the ban on collective bargaining. So I'll start there. I think in a private union relationship, you have a private employer and a private union, and at some level there is, well, we have to make profits or we don't exist anymore, and there's a healthy balance. With government, there is no bottom line, and us, the taxpayers, are ultimately who's being bargained against when we don't have a say. So if a union comes in and demands certain things, and then the government decides to meet that, that impacts us by raised taxes, et cetera. And so I think it's a fundamentally different relationship, and us as taxpayers, who are the ones that end up paying, really don't have any say in that process.
Well, why do we not want our teachers, our firefighters, our public servants, right, people who help feed our children, why do we not want them to be able to kind of negotiate in that way for better benefits, better wages, pensions, retirement, stuff like that?
I think that would be a really great question if that is what we thought. I think everyone can agree we want these people that we all know, we love and respect to be taken care of, to be paid well. And I think you can see that that has happened, and not because of the union representation, but in spite of it. The legislature has increased directly teacher salaries over the last several years, to put us, I think, in the top 10 nationally in starting salaries, and the number one in all of our surrounding states, and really have made that a priority, regardless of whatever the union is trying to do, who has actively opposed those attempts.
Well, they only opposed the teacher raises, right, because they kind of saw it as like a buy our love kind of situation.
Sure. Well, and I whatever the reasoning is, right, I think part of it is, and I think part of this whole campaign is, there's people don't like to lose the control and the influence that they have. And when you go around a union, when you go around the bureaucracy, they lose that control. And what I think most people would agree is we want teachers taken care of. We want our first responders taken care of. There shouldn't be this middleman trying to get in the way of, right, like a $6,000 salary increase for teachers last year.
Yeah, so, but if the unions are not really, you know, raising our taxes because of this, and we're not being harmed, I guess, because of it, why do we need to ban it?
So, I mean, obviously the unions themselves don't raise the taxes, but at some point...
But the cost of, paying teachers and all the people, right?
And taxpayers are on the hook, whether it's happened yet or not, we are ultimately who is responsible for paying those things. I would just like to touch on some of the other aspects of the bill where I think taxpayers really are implicated. The bill prohibits public sector union employees, so employed solely by the union, these are not public workers, into the future from receiving Utah retirement benefits. So taxpayers are currently paying that for something around 60 employees of the unions doing union work, not government work, not work on behalf of the taxpayers. And I think that's fundamentally unfair for taxpayers to be on the hook for that.
And so, aren't there other groups, though, League of Cities and Towns and folks who can tap into the state's retirement fund?
Yep, there absolutely are other organizations. I don't know that we have enough time to get into what I actually believe are major differences and nuances in what some of these organizations do versus what a union is doing on its own behalf versus the league or UAC is really working on the behalf of the government and the cities and the counties that they represent.
Right, but they're not employees.
Correct.
Is kind of your argument
right
there. Okay, so let's get back to the rescission efforts.
Yeah.
So you kind of go out and you try to convince people of all these points, right? What do you make of the numbers that the unions collected? 320,000, yeah. Nothing to shake a stick at.
No, I think it's extremely impressive. I think it goes to their ability to organize and to get their message out. We were doing the same thing at the same time, talking to people. I know they're able to, you know, convince people of their side. We've also seen that where, you know, supporters of people who thought they supported the referendum, you know, came to our side. You're like, you know what, that actually does make sense. This is what I was being told it does. I thought it was banning unions altogether, right? These kind of these scare tactics. And we come to them and tell them unions can still exist. You can still be a member of a union. All of these other benefits still exist. We're just ensuring taxpayer dollars are protected, and we've leveled the playing field with certain aspects, and there's accountability.
So you're accusing them of using scare tactics, and they are accusing you of using scare
tactics. Politics is fun, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you make of them accusing those scare tactics? They're saying you're trying to kind of just scare people that their information is out there, and it is. It's on the Lieutenant Governor's website, right? Because that's the law where people can go in and see who signed these petitions, right? But it goes away eventually.
Sure.
They take it down once the referendum's over.
Yeah, and I mean, we aren't trying to scare people. Obviously, I think it's made aware when you are signing it, this is going to be public. That's not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to scare people into not signing because of that. Mm-hmm. We haven't used those talking points whatsoever. We really talk to the heart of the bill and why we support the underlying policy, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
So the governor said this week that he would be supportive of lawmakers coming back into session to tweak this law to try to stave off this whole referendum.
Yeah.
Now, we have no evidence that that's happening, but what do you know? Is there any talks of that happening?
I honestly have not heard anything additional other than that. Obviously, I like the policy where it's at. There were talks during the legislative session about coming to some sort of compromise. And I understand the policy is incremental, and so if we need to, you know, pivot to do something to ensure the survival of the underlying policies, I think that is the legislative process, and we would definitely stay involved and see how that's going.
So what is the likelihood that you rescind enough signatures to not get this thing on the ballot?
I wish I had a number, Lindsay. I absolutely think it's possible, and we're going to work for the next 45 days to connect with people. I know other groups are working to do that as well. And then inevitably, if it does end up on the ballot, we're prepared to continue messaging, talking to people through the election and encouraging them to vote in favor of keeping HB 267.
Okay, we shall see how this all plays out. Kevin Green, the state director of Americans for Prosperity, we appreciate your time today. Thanks so much. Well, still ahead on Inside Utah Politics, auditors identifying human error as a threat to election security. How one top election official here in Utah is responding to the critiques. Stay with us.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, welcome back. An audit of Utah's election security is sparking some concern on Utah's Capitol Hill. Starting with the good news here, the report found that our election systems have multiple layers of cybersecurity and critical equipment is not connected to the internet, shielding it from remote hacking. On the other hand, senior lawmakers are concerned about human error, leaving systems vulnerable. As an example, some county election staff left passwords written on notes out in the open.
The systems are only as good as the way they're implemented. Precisely. Right here is a complete failure. Is this a real life example?
That's a photo we took on election day, correct.
From one of our counties?
Yes.
That's problematic.
Well, I'm joined today by Ricky Hatch. He's the Weber County Clerk and Auditor. Ricky, thank you for joining me on Inside Utah Politics.
My pleasure, Lindsay.
Well, of course, you heard the speaker there, very concerned about those passwords being left out. I mean, just what's your perspective? How concerned should we be about that?
That's not a good practice, and we should not, those counties that had that happen, those staff should not have done that. Fortunately, what the audit report said and mentioned actually 10 times was the concept of multiple layers of controls and safeguards. And that will help diminish this risk, albeit, you know, it's not acceptable, but it's diminished and compensated for by these other controls.
Well, part of the conversation that you had with the audit committee this week was, okay, these passwords were left out in certain areas, and could someone theoretically break into the building, get these passwords, get into a computer? I think the point you made was that these computers were not actually the ones that tabulated the results, right? They're where we house our voter database. Still, we don't want anyone having access to our voter database, but also to your point, they would have to get through all the locks and the doors and the cameras and all the things that we have in our election in our clerk's offices.
Yeah, that's right. And especially during the election, while we're processing ballots, security is even tighter. And we have staff that are present virtually around the clock when you include security during these times. And so it really is a tight ship. And if you break through one section, there's another one right there to stop you, deter you, or at worst, detect.
Yeah. So part of this audit finding that, you know, people getting casual with passwords, some computers left unsecured, right? So would you say, and part of this discussion too at the audit committee was, are we more vulnerable for an attack from the inside, right? Bad actors who work at the county clerk's office or maybe who are colluding in some way, I know that's kind of out there, or an outside attack, right? Coming in, you know, someone trying to hack our system.
It really depends on the organization. If you have a really strong physical security like Fort Knox kind of strength, then your risk is certainly more insider. Whereas if you're connected to the internet and have all sorts of things that way, you're at more risk from the outside attack. We're kind of in the middle. I'd say we're more vulnerable to an inside attack, but even with that, those multiple layers of controls are really strong to deter even an insider attack.
Run through our controls. Like, I mean, if you had to sell this to the average Utah voter, I mean, make them feel safe, right?
Oh.
About how many controls we do have.
Oh, okay. I'll see if I can remember them all. But we, first off, we do background checks on our election staff. Anybody who touches a computer has to go through mandatory annual training. We conduct audits of the elections, both before, during, and after the election. We conduct what's called hash audits, which I can get into a very technical audit. We have physical security controls, we have cameras, we have reconciliations and logs that are done throughout the process. And if anything is off, we can step back, and let's say the system's compromised, we can step back, completely delete everything, and restart because we've got paper ballots.
Mm. So I do want to dig into that hash audit a little bit. What is it? Because basically it's like a digital fingerprint, right, of anyone accessing the system?
Yes. So when we receive a system from the elections tabulation vendor, it comes with this digital fingerprint, which is a combination of the software, the programs, the system, the firmware, and the hardware. All those come together to create this hash, this fingerprint, that can be independently reproduced by anybody in the world at any time who has access to the system. And what we do, and now it's by state law, we in Utah, we have to actually run that hash audit on the systems. In Weber, we run it before we process any ballots and before we certify the results and compare. And if that number doesn't match, that system's been altered.
So you know that coming in from the vendors, the software that's going on your computers is safe, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. That's how we know. And the testing that goes into the system that generates that hash or that has that hash generated can take up to 18 months before it's certified. And there are two independent national testing laboratories. That's their sole focus, is to identify problems. And once they certify that, this bipartisan federal agency, the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, they give their stamp of approval. The hash is generated, and that never changes. And that's what we audit to.
So our machines also, the audit found, are not connected to the internet, although they do have some wireless capabilities that auditors recommend you just take off altogether. What do you make of the concerns, mostly from the speaker in yesterday's meeting, that he was just really concerned that there were some vulnerabilities? Do you see it the same way?
Well, we should always be concerned when we have vulnerabilities. The audit found them. It was in very small counties. It was very limited. And they, again, mentioned the concept of multi-factor authentication and multiple layers of controls that compensate. They don't remove, but they compensate those risks. So the speaker is perfectly fair to have concerns. We want it to be locked down perfectly. No system ever is. But we'll continue to improve those findings that we found. But we still have those compensating controls that really strengthen the system as a whole.
I think the cyber hack is like the biggest concern out there, right? Because you just don't know where it's coming from. But what would you tell voters to really assuage them that our cybersecurity is robust in Utah?
The systems that scan your ballots are not connected to anything but the power. And this has now been independently certified by experts who are, they're hackers. They came in and they tried to hack our systems statewide. And they found that the systems were secure, strong, and had not changed from that hash validation that was certified. So that software is solid, secure, and unchanged.
But one of the complaints I often hear from county clerks who just tell me it's death by a thousand cuts when it comes to legislation changing Utah's election law, what would you say to lawmakers who may look at this audit, they're nitpicking, right, and looking for those, you know, vulnerabilities, but ultimately you're saying this audit is showing that our cybersecurity is robust?
Yeah, I would just say, come talk to us. Let's talk. We'll walk you through the process. We'll walk you through the controls that we have in place. And if you see a hole, come in and think like a crook, because that's what we try to do. If you see a hole, let us know and we'll try to fix it. Generally, we can fix things like this without legislation.
Think like a criminal. That's what we all tend to do in our daily lives. All right, let's switch gears to the SAVE Act. This is a big national proposal, a bill that's passed the House now that will require proof of citizenship when you register to vote. Talk about implementation in Utah. Is this feasible?
It's feasible. It would be a dramatic shift for voters as well as election officials, but really for voters. Basically, if the SAVE Act were implemented, anytime you move, anytime you register, change your party affiliation, you would now have to come in person and provide evidence of your citizenship. That includes passport, which only about half of Utahns have. Birth certificate studies show that about 10% of citizens have a hard time or don't even have access to that document. And now you have to come do that in person or you won't be registered. That'll be a challenge.
So how do we validate citizenship? Because a lot of voters, I hear from certain sides, support the concept, but how do we prove it if, like you're saying, we don't have these documents or some people, or it disenfranchises people?
Yeah, the concept is sound. You should not vote unless you're a citizen. And I don't know anyone who disagrees with that, at least not in Utah. The way we do it, we're actually already doing it in Utah. Utah's a real ID state. Before anyone gets registered, we verify through the Driver's License Division and the Social Security Administration that their citizenship is valid. If that doesn't work, then we don't register them. So what the process that we go through right now isn't quite strict enough for the SAVE Act. We'd have to implement additional controls, such as people coming in person and showing those documents. But we do that right now.
And just quickly, in our last 30 seconds, one of the biggest pushbacks to this bill I hear is that on your birth certificate, it doesn't say where you were born, right? It doesn't prove your citizenship, right? And so married women, right, who maybe had their maiden name on their birth certificate, would that impact them? They would have to change that. Mike Lee says that's not the case, and states are allowed to figure it out. What's the truth? Yeah,
I tend to agree with Mike Lee on this one. The language of the bill leaves it up to the states, as it should. And one thing that we're good at in Utah is working together, states and locals, to come up with something that makes sense for the voters but still accomplishes the concept of security and integrity.
We don't think it's likely it'll get heard in the Senate or pass the Senate at this point. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
you
right.
See that? Okay, very good. Ricky Hatch, Weber County Clerk and Auditor, thank you so much for your thoughts today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Governor Cox fielding questions from a packed room of reporters. That's coming up on Inside Utah Politics. We get into these hot button issues addressed at his monthly press conference. Stay with us. Well, Utah Governor Spencer Cox is hopeful that the legislature won't be overriding any of six vetoes this year. It's one of the topics he touched on during his monthly press conference. He says while he is still expecting a special session, he's not in talks with any lawmakers to stave off an override vote. In fact, he thinks some of the bills he vetoed have an even less support now.
I had several legislators on a couple of those vetoes who actually voted for the bills who came back to me and said, hey, after reading your letter, I agree with you. That makes sense to me. And so I think it's fairly unlikely we'll have a veto override, but that it wouldn't surprise me if they did.
Well, the legislature has until May 6 to override any vetoes. The governor also shed some light on the state's role in planning downtown Salt Lake City's future. And I asked him about a meeting he had with Salt Lake County Mayor Jenny Wilson and billionaire Ryan Smith. He says it's important for the state to be involved in the early phases of a complicated project like demolishing and rebuilding parts of the Salt Palace. Cox also pushed back on the idea that the state is not contributing enough money, a complaint voiced by some members of the Salt Lake City Council.
The people that will benefit the most from it, though, are the city and county, and so it makes sense that they would share a bigger burden than people who live in Sampe County or San Juan County.
Well, the governor did not shy away from hot-button national issues either. Cox says he's very concerned about the Trump administration's refusal to return Kilmar Obrego-Garcia to the U.S. The mistakenly deported legal Maryland resident is stranded in El Salvador despite a 9-0 Supreme Court order to have him returned. Well, the governor believes the Trump administration should listen to the court, but that Garcia should ultimately be deported, but legally this time.
I think you can bring him back, go through the process, and then have him deported. And that's probably the way it should work. It really does matter that we hold to these constitutional norms.
Now, the Obrego-Garcia case has a complicated legal history, rather, and you can visit our website, abc4.com, for reporting on his legal status and the ongoing battle over his deportation. Well, that does it for today's Inside Utah Politics. Now, don't forget, if you have any local political stories you'd like to see, make sure to reach out. You can email me at insideutahpolitics@abc4.com. You can also follow along with me on social media. I'm always posting on X, Blue Sky, Threads, Lindsay on Air on Instagram as well. Just search for my name, Lindsay, spelled with an A. And then you can also find our show online in podcast form. Wherever you podcast, just search for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ertz. Well, thank you for joining us this week. We'll see you next week on Inside Utah Politics.